Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. This is Alf speaking. It's Thursday, the 10th of March, 2022. And I'm here joined today by Imran Laka, who is the founder of Options Insight. Hi, Imran. How are you doing?
Hey, Alf. How are you?
Hey, all good, man. Late for both of us, but let's get this one started. There is a lot to unpack today as well. So we have equity markets, you know, mildly down on the day. We have bond yields staging quite a move, especially in Europe, as the ECB surprised markets on the hawkish side today. We also have, you know, commodities moving all over the place, as always. We got to get used to that, apparently. And we have Bitcoin repricing down, too. So before we go into each of these asset classes, I want people to know that you are a pretty broad macro asset class guy, although your specifics is options. So can you give us a little bit of an overview from a macro option perspective of how do you see markets today?
Sure. So, you know, clearly, you know, the biggest driver right now is the geopolitics, right? You know, every headline out of Russia is moving the market by 1% pretty much in equities. So that's the main driver. We've obviously had big hawkish shifts out of all the central banks over the past few months. That's repriced massively, you know, the rotation between cyclicals, energy, and then out of tech and things like that. It's been a massive theme. But, you know, you had kind of under the surface, you had things like Europe starting to rally and, you know, potentially the PMIs ticking up in Europe, and we were looking for some outperformance in Europe, and everyone came in kind of consensus long this year looking for Europe to outperform and maybe the US to underperform. And they basically got caught wrong-footed, right? When this Russia-Ukraine thing happened, Europe just got absolutely trashed. So I think we had the biggest outflow, weekly outflow out of European equities ever last week, something like $7 billion. And that was from Bank of America's sort of data. And that just shows you, you know, how wrong-footed everyone got. And then you've had big moves in Euro, obviously Euro vol. Typically trades around 6%. That's kind of doubled in the last few weeks as Euro just smashed back down. I mean, it was starting to look pretty precarious for the Euro in that what was happening, potentially throwing Europe into a recession, whereas the Fed likely was kind of handcuffed, needing to hike in the face of these inflationary commodity moves. Hence why Euro, you know, retested that 108 level earlier this week. Huge level on a technical basis. Now they've come out with the idea of euro bonds. They've come out with a bit of a hawkish pivot in the meeting today, and we've had a bounce. But look how quickly it's getting faded, right? So for me, that price action is very telling, and it suggests that the market isn't really believing this hawkish pivot and is saying, you know what, if this war drags on, you ain't going to be able to do anything, right? So that's what the market's saying. Let's see how it plays out. But yeah, that's the sort of stuff I'm looking at the moment closely.
Yeah. And so in your reports, Macro Insights, and in the work at Option Insights, you always tend to look, or very often tend to look at the optionality side of things, or the volatility side of things, not necessarily the outright moves, right? Whether it's going up or down, but rather play the volatility side, which we're going to cover a bit later. And, you know, I just want to make sure the audience knows that when you talk about a 6 vol or a 12 vol or you know, these technicalities, we're going to get a little bit into that because Imran has some insights there as well. But now on Europe, because there are two news of the day, right? One is the ECB meeting. The other one is the inflation number. Those are the two big news of the day in America. And so let's start from Europe first. And so the ECB today came to the wire. And, you know, the press conference from Lagarde, but even before the press conference, actually, the monetary policy decisions from the ECB surprised the market from the hawkish side. They decided to cut the quantitative easing program a bit, you know, shorter than it was supposed to be. So, you know, the estimates are now for it to be ending somewhere in Q3, might mean July, might mean September. which also sets the stage potentially for rate hikes from the ECB earlier than market thought. And so the bond market also moved. How do you interpret this decision making by the European Central Bank? And do you think rates market and overall reaction to this ECB meeting was accurate?
Look, I'm looking at the euro to kind of guide me into thinking, you know, what this means. And the euro's telling me that the market's not buying it, basically, right? I mean, clearly, we have had a bond market reaction, naturally. But I think the jury's out on how aggressive the Europeans can be. I think the Fed's going to have to be much more aggressive, yeah? But I think unless we get a really fast resolution of this thing, we get ceasefire, like proper, you know, de-escalation and ceasefire within the next couple of weeks, and things can get a bit back to normal. And I'm skeptical how fast they can get back to normal, even with that news flow. I think Europe's got, you know, a few struggles ahead of it, basically. And you haven't seen the same wage, you haven't seen the same wage inflation in Europe and stuff like that. So I don't think the pressure is going to be on as much for Europe to tighten as it is for the US. And I think that's going to impact euro and the dollar, obviously, and taking the dollar higher, basically.
The other important thing, obviously, Imran, is that one thing is how do we think the Fed or the ECB are going to tighten, and the other thing is what's the market pricing in today, right? I mean, it's always trying to trade against consensus, whether you're going to beat consensus or not, right? Same for the forward market. And so if I look at Fed funds future or OIS swaps in Europe, what's priced in for the ECB and the Fed to deliver this year for the ECB is round about 3 hikes, basically, before the meeting. It now got priced to be basically 0% ECB deposit rate in 1 year from now, by March 2023. And the Federal Reserve in 1 year from now is priced to deliver something like 170, 180 basis point of hikes, which already tells you that the market sort of expects the Federal Reserve to do more than the ECB. Yeah. I mean, their dry powder is much higher. We all know that, but it's also about the pace, really, and the surprises against what the Fed funds future and the OIS swaps are pricing in both markets.
I think that's a great point in terms of what the market's pricing. I agree with you. The only thing I would say, though, is, you know, in this massive world of uncertainty, you may get a move back towards that kind of US dollar safety type dynamic, right? Where look at it from a vol perspective as well, right? As I love to do, right? Eurostoxx volatility, the main index in Europe, went to 60 in the front end, and whereas US S&P was at 35. That's a 25 vol differential, which is pretty much unheard of, right? Like, my subscribers will know I was banging the drum on Monday about that trade, like finding a way to sell European vol to buy S&P vol, because that spread just wasn't going to stay there, basically. And even if it did stay there, the way it was priced, you had pretty good odds of a relative value volatility trade where you could sell strangles on Europe and buy strangles on S&P, and the break-evens just looked fantastic.
Hey, everyone. We're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of today's top analysis on Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to. Podcasts on?
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus? Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Wait a second, because you said so
I've gone way too far, haven't I?
You've said so much good stuff. We need to unpack it. Give me a second. So let's start from the very beginning. Eurostoxx vol and S&P vol. So we moved from the bond market to the equity market, and we're looking for trades that are rather relative value than outright trades. So we are looking for realized volatility to be lower or higher than implied volatility in two different stock markets, the European stock market, the American stock market. And you said something, Imran. The Euro stocks implied volatility, especially at the front end, so short tenors, is pricing in 60% annualized volatility. So unpack that for us. What does it mean on an implied daily volatility?
So the easiest way to think about an implied volatility number is it's your market's expectation of how volatile the asset's going to be up to a specified time period. And then that number is annualized. Okay. Now for us, it's easier to think in terms of daily moves than it is in annual moves. So literally all you need to do is take that implied vol number, divide it by the square root of 252, which is roughly 16, right? And that will tell you what the market price is as a daily move for the asset. So a 60 vol asset is basically being priced to move almost 4% a day, right? A 35 vol asset is being priced to move 2% a day, right? Which is half that amount, okay? So that was, and you know, obviously in the last sort of couple of weeks, we've had Europe underperform quite badly before that massive squeeze that we saw yesterday, whatever it was. But, you know, you had about a 10% underperformance in about a week from Europe. And my thesis was, if we continue to break down, I don't think the S&P is just going to ignore it, right? The S&P can ignore it for so long, but there comes a point where if the news flow continues to deteriorate, everyone's now switched out of Europe, as we saw from the outflows. They're camped back into US stocks, hoping that they're going to be the safe haven. And then you get that leg down where everyone has to dump what they own, right? Which is the US. So you can have a situation where the European markets get exhausted to the downside and the US market actually sells off. And then that's exactly what went on to happen in those few days, where the S&P went from 4,300 to 4,150 lows and Euro stocks did nothing and then actually squeezed hard yesterday. Right, like 7% or 8% or something, right? So you had, you basically, that was, that you could see from the volatility price action that the European sell-off was getting quite exhausted, basically.
Yeah.
Right? And that was the idea.
And the other important thing you said is that if you structure the trade in a certain way and you time it right as well, the odds of the trade realizing your way are high. So traders like us tend to think in this way, the odds of a trade realizing, which means it's always a probabilistic assessment. And the way you chose to do this trade is in a relative value term, volatility-wise. So you only need the European stock market to realize that the lower implied volatility compared to what the S&P realizes against their implied volatilities to basically make money out of the trade. So it's a risk measure trade, basically speaking, right?
Yeah, and well, the thing about options as well is there's multiple ways to implement your view and your idea, right? So for me, like, you know, I saw that vol spread go to 25. So I was like immediately drawn to that and say, okay, European vol's expensive, US vol's cheap, what am I going to do about it? Now, I didn't want to put on that trade and then sit there all day trading the volatility and the realized and literally having to stare in front of my screen all day, because that's not what I like to do as a retail trader, right? So what I like to do is put a trade on that I can just put on, take advantage of the dislocation and then leave it and let it breathe, right? So the way I implemented the trade was to say, well, the pricing in Europe is such that I can sell a strangle. And what a strangle is where you sell an out of the money put and you sell an out of the money call and you hope the market stays inside that range and you get to collect premium, okay? So that the strangle that I could sell in Europe was 20% out of the money expiring in a month. So I could sell a 20% out of the money call, I could sell a 20% out of the money put and I could collect premium, okay? With that same premium that I collected, I could then go and buy an S&P strangle, but the strikes that I got on the S&P, because the vol was so much cheaper, were much more like 90% and 110%, as opposed to 80% and 120%. So you get to basically own volatility on the S&P and start making money plus or minus 10%, and you won't lose money on your Eurostoxx leg until we do 20% either way. So, and the idea was that I can stick that trade on. If the market moves in either direction, I like my odds, right, of getting into a position that is going to go in the money, right? And if the market does nothing, the vol spread can converge. That's exactly what's happened. And the vol spread's gone from 25 back to about 10 now, right? So the money's been made via that compression. If I sit there and do nothing for the next 4 weeks, I won't make any money because both of the premiums will net each other out. But if I want to take some money out of the trade now, I can, because the vol spread has already started to come in, right? So there's multiple dimensions to trading options, where you've got the vol element, you've got the movement in the market element, you've got lots of things that you can play, and there's different ways of implementing it and having exposure to those parameters.
Fantastic. So this was effectively a zero cost structure option implementation that gives you some decent odds to make money, or if in this case they gave you some odds of making money, and also makes you sleep at night because you paid basically literally nothing for the trade. So with options you can play around in a smart way, and Imran is a specialist in that. Imran, I also know that you look at crypto volatility as well. Again, not outright moves necessarily, but rather volatility of the crypto space. Can you tell us more about that? Like, I'm really seriously interested because I only scratched the surface on that topic.
Yeah, I mean, crypto vol is hot. It's a hot space right now. I mean, I've been in it for about 2 years. And I mean, it was a lot of fun to trade, right? The reason being that the asset's so volatile, right? So generally, if you're trading options, you want to trade options on an asset that moves around, and you want the volatility of the asset to move around. And that's, crypto's got that in spades, right? Obviously, we've had some interesting moves in crypto in the last few days or weeks, right? I mean, it was a risk asset correlated to the NASDAQ for ages. And then all of a sudden, it had a pop on the capital controls with Russia. And then it faded because everyone's nervous about this executive order out of Biden, which turned out to be a nothing done. And then we popped again. But it's very choppy. I don't think he can make his mind up whether it's a risk asset or whether it's some sort of gold, digital gold proxy, right? And I think the market's trying to figure that out as well. I mean, there were some encouraging signs on crypto in terms of the uses, the use cases in an emergency. Like, Ukraine managed to raise, I think, over $50 million to help them fight the war. You've got people on the ground in Ukraine using it as a medium exchange, like buy cars and stuff, which I found quite hilarious. And then you've also got the whole angle about it's, you know, criminals going to use it and to circumvent sanctions and stuff. I mean, there's evidence, Coinbase, Binance, of freezing accounts of sanctioned people. So they can't do anything with their crypto. Now, they may have other crypto that's not on those exchanges, that's like cold storage, that they might be able to play around with. But the point is, there are some ways to, if they're holding on exchange, then there's some ways to monitor it and clamp down on that. But I'm going off on one a bit about crypto use cases. But in terms of the volatility side of things, there's big dislocations in crypto vol that have kind of come about over the last few months. And whilst the asset still wings around like an animal, the implied volatility kind of trades systematically cheap at the moment, right? In the absolute front part of the curve, which is where you can get exposure to realized vol, because you can, the Greek that you buy is gamma to get exposure to realized vol, and that comes from super short dated options. So you've got a dynamic in crypto markets where you've got this new player that has entered the space, which is the DeFi option vaults. And they are basically a retail product of sorts that encourages people in the DeFi world to lock up their coins and earn yield by selling either covered calls or selling puts against stablecoin collateral, basically. Okay, so there's a vol selling yield hunting exercise, and it's wrapped up within this product that is then, the guy just puts it in the vault and forgets about it and just earns their yield. They don't have to like do any of the option trading themselves, basically. But what it does, it's attracted so much capital, and I think it's going to attract a ton more. I think it's early days, but it's attracted so much capital that there is this natural now supply. There's indiscriminate supply. Doesn't care really where the implied volatility is. They just sell it every week, right? So that is a gamma supply that's hitting the street every week, making crypto gamma basically too cheap, right? So if you have events like what's going on in the world right now, you can pick up on a Friday morning, you can pick up some pretty cheap crypto vol if you fancy a move, basically. And that's the kind of stuff I've been doing, right? I've been leaning on that flow. I've been picking it up when I wanted some gamma and things like that. And it's quite nice, as in it's quite a nice trade to kind of game around that, because it's predictable flow, right? And being an ex-banker, that was part of my skill set, right? If I've got a predictable flow that I know is coming every week, how do I play against that? How do I, you know, trade against that, pre-position for it, take advantage of it, things like that. So those are the type of trades I've been doing and I've been telling my subscribers about, and, you know, kind of guiding them through that whole mentality, basically.
Imran, that's super interesting. I have to admit, I didn't know much of what you just said, but I learned a lot. I have a more direct question, which is, Where is implied volatility for our audience in Bitcoin at the moment, for example? So
it's around 70. It's around 70, 75. Yeah.
Okay. So you need to divide that by 16 again.
Well, no, you don't, actually. You divide it by 19 because it's open 7 days a week.
That's a very fair remark. Exactly. Yeah. So you divide it by 19, which means that the market is pricing Bitcoin to have daily moves of around about 4%, 3.5%, something like that.
Something like that, exactly, Yeah, it's right now the 40,000 is around 72 vol, basically,
Interesting. So also in crypto, you can apply these strategies that Imran is talking about. And actually, it makes it even more interesting because, as he just described, there is effectively a systematic volatility selling program from yield-enhancing Bitcoin programs or coins programs, right, that they tend to sell volatility indiscriminately, systematically to the market, which makes it even more interesting. Imran, as we're talking about Bitcoin, I think our audience will be interested to hear the piece that an interview that Ash did with Chris Perkins and Chris Giancarlo on Bitcoin and on the discussions we are having. And I want to pick your brain as well on the basically the central banking attempt at creating replication for digital assets, in this case CBDCs. Mm-hmm. And so let's hear to what Chris Perkins and Chris Giancarlo had to discuss with Ash Bennington.
Most of the world's central banks, including our own Federal Reserve, are eventually going to experiment with their own form of sovereign digital money, a digital dollar, central bank digital currency, and having to try to play an influence as to what that looks like, because I'm very concerned that it must reflect the values of a free society if it's going to be successful and if it's going to serve that free society. So the answer is I'm using my time now engaged in the world of ideas, the battle for the future. In my book, I call the future, the fight for the future of money. What is the future of money and banking and all that comes out of it? We're looking at what's going on in Europe right now, talking about the role of dollars in sanctions power. You know, there's so much that comes away. You know, if you change finance and banking and money, that has sociological impacts. It has geopolitical impacts. That has issues of protecting our least successful, our least well-off in this world. So the ideas that go into the future of money, the evolution of that future is where my heart, where my mind is right now.
And so the full interview is available at the Real Vision Crypto tier for people interested in listening more about that. But Imran, also your opinion on the central bank's attempt, moving for a second aside from the technical side of implied volatility of Bitcoin. Let's talk for a second about the attempt from central banks to create CBDCs and what this might mean for the whole digital asset space. Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, I mean, I have an opinion about central bank digital currencies in that they scare the shit out of me, if I'm allowed to say that.
Sure.
But basically, you know, the amount of control that it gives the government and to surveil everything you do with your money, your money can maybe even expire. They can tax different people at different rates to incentivize behaviors. I mean, it scares the hell out of me, right? And I think... But crypto isn't that, right? If anything, and, you know, Raoul put out a good piece years ago about this, the life raft, right? Mm-hmm. He's saying that crypto is like this life raft away from that future, because that is going to be your only version of anonymous cash, right? If you can, you know, that you currently can use cash and give it to anyone and no one will know, you can't do that with CBDCs, right? So if Bitcoin is your only way of doing that, there's a place for it in the world, right? And everyone's going to want to have some, I suspect, right? Or a lot of people are. So I don't think CBDCs are a threat to... I think they will encourage more people to want to use things like Bitcoin, personally.
Yeah, so the CBDC side is definitely a monetary policy / policy making tool, I think. Although disguised as we want to bank the unbanked and whatever, you know, a slogan is out there, it's definitely a way to make sure that monetary policy can be stretched to the point where if there are physical cash limitations to where interest rates can go, with a fully virtual and perhaps more centrally controlled CBDC version of the already existing digital money that we have, so digital bank deposits. If you make the supply of credit of these digital bank deposits being almost fully controlled by a central policymaker, it can also apply different tax rates, different monetary policy regimes, et cetera, which, you know, moves the whole central planning monetary policy to a whole different level, to be honest. Yes.
And the point the gentleman made about, you know, it needs to be, you need to consider people's freedoms and things like that, right? I mean, just look at COVID, right? Different countries have treated COVID so differently, right? Well, what have they done in Australia relative to what they've done in the US or the UK? Mm-hmm. UK's dropped all restrictions right now. Can you go to a restaurant in France without showing a vaccine pass right now? I don't think you can, right?
Yeah, I don't
think in the UK, you can do what the hell you want. So how different countries are going to use their own CBDCs and the amount of freedom and the amount of rights people are going to have are going to differ greatly, right? Because we've seen that in this last issue that the world has had to deal with for the last few years, right?
We're going to take another quick break to hear words from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510, is he declaring an emergency? There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Fair point. So let's move away again from the philosophical side of things back into the action, because in your reports at Options Insider and Macro Insights, you also talk about actionable trade ideas, which I love as a former risk taker, and I do the same as well at the Macro Compass. So can you tell us what would be your top pick at the moment as a trade?
Right, top picks. Like I said, the one that I did on Monday was this kind of RV trade between Eurostoxx Vol and S&P. So that was kind of my top pick this week. Trades that I've been running, I've had some short-dated Bitcoin straddles, 42,000 straddles. Like I said, that gamma trade systematically cheap. So I was buying 1 week straddles and selling 1 month, like April strangles against it to get some time decay back. So the idea was the market's going to kind of move away from 42,000. But once it does, the implied volatility in April isn't going to budge very much because it's already at 75 or whatever, right? So the idea is that you're going to get your move, your straddle is going to make money, but the implied vol short that you've got in April isn't going to hurt you. So that's like, again, quite a complex vol trade, which, you know...
Wait a second. Let's stop there. Let's analyze it for a second. So that's a very interesting one. So effectively, you were saying... Short term, in a very short period,
one week,
I believe that the implied volatility priced by the market is too low.
So I think the break even on my straddle is too low. So the market can easily move through those break evens.
Yeah, so we're going to have some volatile moves which are not priced in over the next week or so, right? So, but to buy that that optionality, it's pretty expensive, right? So you have to effectively pay premium both sides to do that, right? So then what you did is you sold some optionality more long dated. So you said once we have this boom in the short term, it's going to all come back in terms of volatility, right? Is that a correct assessment?
Well, when it's not about like this, again, this is a mistake a lot of people make in terms of when they think about option positions and calendar positions, taking different expiry positions at the same time. So when you do that, you're not taking a view about the path the market's going to take in a week and then later in the next month, right? Because you're just taking a view on the path of all of those options today. How are they going to move relative to each other, right? So the 1 week straddle is a simple trade, right? It costs a certain amount. The market either moves by that amount or it doesn't, right?
Yes.
If it stays at 42,000, you make nothing. You lose the entire premium of that straddle. If it moves by 3,000 points, you get your money back because that was the break even of the strategy.
Yeah.
Okay. If it moves by 5,000 points, then you make loads of money. You make 2,000 with that, right? So that's a break even trade, right? The April, on the other hand, is more of a Vega trade, right? So the idea is you're selling that, you're selling it delta neutral, right? So you're selling out of the money options expiring in like 6 weeks or whatever it is, okay? End of April, so a bit more than that, nearly 2 months. But what you're saying is that whilst if the market moves, my weekly straddle will go in the money and make me money, but the damage that I'm going to take on my short 2 month strangle will be limited because that implied volatility won't go against me too badly because it's already priced at 75,
yeah.
Right? So I suspect the market won't reprice that too dramatically. That's the point. And in the meantime, if the market doesn't move, that vol could go lower and that thing earns me some time decay to help finance the weekly straddle that I'm long, basically, right? So that's the argument.
A proper options teacher, Imran. Really great. Now, we have a question from the audience, a couple of those. Before we wrap up, I would like the audience to get at least one occasion to ask you a question. So Ryan from the Real Vision website, he's asking something about implied volatility and historical volatility using your expertise in options clearly. So he says there is IV, HV, and the ratio of IV and HV, so implied vol and historical vol. What are your thoughts on implied volatility? Historical volatility is sometimes referred to on the street as volatility premium. What are your thoughts on the ratio between implied vol and historical vol?
Systematically, there should be a vol premium, right? Because it's a lot easier to sleep at night being long vol than it is short vol.
Yeah.
So there is a premium typically to harvest, and that is a systematic alpha that vol traders have traded from the beginning of options because implied typically trades above realized, right? Because people are willing to pay for that protection, that tail risk, whatever it may be. Okay, it's like an insurance premium, you could kind of think of it as, okay? It's just that sometimes that spread can move around because you get a load of movement and yet people don't think that movement's gonna persist. So they don't reprice the implieds up too much. They're like, that's an anomaly that's going to settle down and the implieds stay low. And if you, for whatever reason, think that that the market's going to keep moving, then there's your opportunity because you get to buy that implied below realized, which is quite rare. Okay. But over the long term and the majority of the time, there will be a premium. Okay. And then it's quite a good question for now, because at the moment, and I put out a tweet about this the other day about commodities and, tracking some of the major commodities like wheat, oil, copper, gold, right? And all their implieds have obviously exploded as they've started moving. And but a lot of them are trading, the implieds are trading almost 200% of the realized vol. So if you measure the historic vol and you look at the implied, it's almost double. So that's a very high implied vol premium, which would make you, you know, you just look at that blindly and say, well, vol's way too expensive, okay? But what that historic vol number doesn't take into account is intraday moves, right? It only takes into account the close-to-close volatility. And if you look at things like oil, things like wheat, things like nickel, right? I mean, the intraday vol was like insane. Yeah. I mean, even on the S&P, I was looking at it today, right? A good measure of the intraday vol is the ATR, the average true range. And the average true range on the S&P, if you look at 14 days, is like 105, which is like 2.5%. If you look at the realized vol, it's more like 25, 28%, something like that. So you've got a big differential between what the ATR vol would be, which is in the 40s or around 40, whereas the close-to-close vol is like 28, right? And then the VIX is sitting somewhere in the middle in the sort of low 30s, basically, mid to low 30s. So that's why the VIX is trading a bit higher than realized, because the guys who do own Gamma are able to monetize these swings, right? These intraday swings, they can trade them and they can capture that movement. And the guys who are short Gamma are getting chopped about by that movement, right? And they don't like that, hence they're gonna bid that vol back and they're not gonna be comfortable shorting it so much, right? So people who are looking for, you know, again, I'm getting quite technical here, but people who are looking for this Vanna rally that we often get in markets where vol comes down, put premiums get crushed, deltas, dealers have to buy back all the delta hedges against it. They call it a Vanna rally, right? And that's reliant on implied vols collapsing, okay?
Yeah.
But if the market's so volatile intraday right now to the level that they are compared to where vol is, I think we're going to need a bit of time and a bit of stabilization of intraday vol before you get a significant enough collapse in volatility to fuel a real VANA rally that takes us back to 4,400 and beyond, basically.
Right. Wow, what an answer. I just have a backup question, which is not from the audience, it's from myself, but I guess it helps the audience as well. You basically went and say there is some alpha trades in options, but you made sure to say alpha trades in options. Yeah. So can you tell us why, you know, that remark about alpha trades in options? What are traders doing where they're trying to monetize the difference between implied vol and historical vol?
Well, it's just a buzzword, isn't it, right? Alpha. Everyone wants to generate alpha. That's what differentiates you in the markets these days, right? Like just having beta to the market doesn't make you stand out. You have to outperform. You have to generate alpha, right? And so that's why I had it in inverted commas. But, you know, systematically selling vol tends to be an alpha generating strategy, right, over time, because vol usually trades expensive. Problem is, when you're going in this massive volatility regime shift that we've gone through this year, and we've had multiple reasons behind it, right, that is not a good strategy, systematically selling vol anymore. Okay. Yeah. And anyone who thinks it is like smoking something, basically, right? Yes. So I would say, actually, buying dips in vol this year is probably a better trade. I think looking at the VIX, it was floored at 15 last year. Mm-hmm. I think the floor is jacked up at least 5, if not 10 vols this year.
Wow.
Right? Certainly for the first half of the year, while we got all this Ukraine stuff happening, we're tightening into a slowdown, arguably all hell could break loose, right? I mean, looking at some of the stuff Darius says, and I'm a big fan of Darius Dale, 42 macro, you know, we could arguably see a 30 to 50% sell-off in equities, right? So don't think the VIX is going sub 20 in that world, right? So I would say the new floor in VIX is probably around 20, maybe even slightly higher, and probably buying dips in it makes sense, right? And if you're going to buy the dip in the market, which I'll be honest, I've been trying to do for like a month now, but I've been doing it safely. And you have to do it via call spreads, maybe call flies, those type of structures where you can spend a bit of premium, make 3 to 5 times that premium if you get the rally, but if you sell off and you're protected, basically you only lose your premium, right? That's the only way to buy these dips right now.
Imran, just to top it off, I think you are amongst the best guys out there when it comes to teaching options to retail guys who want to learn. You have skin on, hands-on experience in that. You're a great communicator as well and a great teacher. In case people want to find more about you, where can they do that?
Sure. So options_insight is my Twitter handle. I'm pretty active on there, tweeting sort of daily tweet threads about cross-asset stuff and volatility. You can visit my website, which is options-insight.com. We offer online options courses. We offer live boot camps where we teach options. In fact, we've got one coming up on the 26th and 27th of March weekend. So that's a virtual Zoom course where I recruit, enroll people and teach them all my options stuff. And then we have our subscription service, which is Macro Insight, which is kind of the hand-holding service. Like I always say to people, I can teach you everything about options in 2 days, but that doesn't make you an options trader, right? You have to kind of practice it. You have to actually implement positions and feel them and feel the P&L and live and breathe it and bounce ideas off people and stuff like that. And that's what Macro Insight allows you to do. You can, it's my subscription. You have access to me once a week on a Zoom call. Yeah, we have a Discord server where you can access me real time. We're growing a nice little community in there. So,
well, guys, Imran, I think, has proved himself. And thanks for being here today, Imran, on the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Ash, guys, will be back tomorrow with Raul himself. So something you can't really miss. You don't want to miss that. And something else to add is that Real Vision is hiring. So as you're a viewer and a listener, maybe you want to check out and go work with Real Vision, you can check them out on their website. I will see you guys somewhere over the next few weeks. Thank you, Imran, again, for being here today. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, mate. Thanks a lot.
What's up, revolutionaries? Thanks for tuning in to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. For more content like this, head over to realvision.com and get unfiltered access to the very best, brightest, and biggest names in finance.